Chapter 62. Penner rose from a chair, turned, and faced the surviving members of the mate team who were seated in an office inside one of the commercial aircraft hangars. He tapped ashes from his pipe in a bucket of sand beside a desk and nodded at two men, one sitting, the other standing along the rear wall. "I'm going to turn the briefing over to Clyde Ingram, the gentleman in the loud Hawaiian shirt. Clyde is blessed with the fancy title of Director of Science and Technical Data Interpretation. He'll explain his discovery. Then Curtis Meeker, an old friend from my Secret Service days and Deputy Director of Advanced Technical Operations, will explain what's circulating in his warped mind." Ingram walked over to an easel with a blanket thrown over it. He stared from blue eyes through expensive designer glasses attached to cord that dangled around the nape of his neck. His hair was a neatly combed brown, and he lived inside a medium-sized body whose upper works was covered by a black Aloha shirt that looked as if it had been worn in a Ferrari driven around Honolulu by Tom Selleck as Thomas Magnum. He threw the blanket off the easel and gestured a casual thumb toward a large photograph of what appeared to be an old aircraft. "What you see here is a World War II B-29 Superfortress resting 36 miles from Soseki Island on the seabed, 320 meters, or for those of you who have trouble converting to metrics, a little over 1,000 feet below the surface." "The picture is so clear," said Stacy. "Was it taken from a submersible?" "The aircraft was originally picked up by our Pyramider 11 reconnaissance satellite during an orbit over Soseki Island." "You can get a picture that sharp on the bottom of the sea from an orbiting satellite?" she asked in disbelief. "We can." Giordino was sitting in the rear of the room, his feet propped on the chair in front of him. "How does the thing work?" "I won't offer you an in-depth description because it would take hours, but let's just say it works by using pulsating sound waves that interact with very low-frequency radar to create a geophysical image of underwater objects and landscapes." Pitt stretched to relieve tense muscles. "What happens after the image is received?" "The pyramider feeds the image, little more than a smudge, to a tracking data relay satellite that relays it to White Sands, New Mexico, for computer amplification and enhancement. The image is then passed on to the National Security Agency, where it is analyzed by both humans and computers. In this particular case, our interest was aroused, and we called for an SR-90 Casper to obtain a more detailed picture." Stacy raised a hand. "Does Casper use the same imagery system as the Pyramider?" Ingram shrugged in regret. "Sorry, all I can reveal without getting into trouble is that Casper obtains real-time imaging recorded on analog tape. You might say that comparing the Pyramider and Casper systems is like comparing a flashlight beam to a laser. One covers a large spread, while the other pinpoints a small spot." Mancuso tilted his head and stared at the blown-up photograph curiously. "So, what's the significance of the old sunken bomber? What possible connection can it have with the Kaiten project?" Ingram flicked a glance at Mancuso and then tapped a pencil on the photo. "This aircraft, what's left of it, is going to destroy Soseki Island and the Dragon Center." Nobody believed him, not for an instant. They all stared at him as though he was a con man selling a cure-all elixir to a bunch of rubes at a carnival. Giordino broke the silence. "A mere trifle to raise the plane and repair it for a bombing run." Dr. Nogami forced a smile. "It'd take considerably more than a 50-year-old bomb to make a dent in the Dragon Center." Ingram smiled back at Nogami. "Believe me, the bomb inside this B-29 has the punch to do the job. The plot thickens." Pitt nodded glumly. "I smell a snow job coming on." Ingram did a neat sidestep. "That part of the briefing will come from my partner in crime, Curtis Meeker." Pitt's sardonic stare went from Ingram to Meeker. "You two and Ray Jordan and Don Kern must all play in the same sandbox." "We have occasion to mix it up now and then," Meeker replied without smiling. Ingram turned again to the easel, removed the photograph, and propped it on a chair, revealing a close-up photo of a little devil painted on the side of the aircraft's bow. "Denning's Demons," he said, tapping a pencil on the faded letters beneath the little devil. "Commanded by Major Charles Dennings. Please note the little demon is standing on a gold brick marked 24 carat. The crew enjoyed referring to themselves as gold brickers after they were reprimanded for tearing apart a beer hall during training in California." "Obviously my kind of guy," said Giordino. "Unknown, forgotten, and buried deep in Langley files, until a few days ago when Curtis and I dug out the facts, was the story of a very courageous group of men who set out on a very secret mission to drop an atom bomb on Japan." "They what?" Weatherhill was incredulous, but no more so than the others. Ingram ignored the interruption and went on. At about the same time as Colonel Tibbetts took off in the Enola Gay from Tinian Island in the Pacific with the bomb known as Little Boy, Major Dennings lifted off Shemya Island far to the north in the Aleutians with his bomb, which was codenamed Mother's Breath. What was left of the report on the mission was heavily censored, but we believe Dennings' flight plan called for him to follow a one-way course, dropping his bomb on the target, probably Osaka or Kyoto, and then continuing to Okinawa to refuel before pushing on to Tinian. As we all know from the history books, Tibbetts successfully dropped his bomb on Hiroshima. Dennings, unfortunately, vanished, and the entire event was covered over by presidential order. "Hold on a minute," said Mancuso. "Are you telling us that we built more than three bombs in 1945? Stacy cleared her throat. "Except for Little Boy, the first Trinity bomb at Los Alamos, and Fat Man, which was dropped on Nagasaki, no other bombs are recorded. We still don't have the exact count, but it appears there were at least six. Most were of the implosion type, like Fat Man." Pitt said, "Dennings' bomb makes four. That still leaves two." A bomb with the code name of Mother's Pearl was loaded aboard a super fort called Love and Lil on Guam not too long after the island was liberated from the Japanese. Love and Lil was in the air flying toward Japan when Bach's car, piloted by Major Charles Sweeney, dropped Fat Man on Nagasaki. After word was received that the drop went off as planned, Love and Lil and her crew were recalled back to Guam, where the bomb was dismantled and shipped back to Los Alamos. That leaves one. Ocean Mother was on Midway Island, but was never airborne. "Who came up with those awful names?" murmured Stacy. Ingram shrugged. "We have no idea." Pitt looked at Ingram. Were Dennings and the crews on Guam and Midway part of Colonel Tibbetts' 509th Bomber Squadron? Again, we don't know. 80% of the records have been destroyed. We can only guess that General Grove, the director of the Manhattan Bomb Project, and his staff came up with a complicated backup plan at the last moment because there was great fear the firing mechanisms on the bombs might not work. There was also the possibility, although unlikely, that the Enola Gay or boxcar might crash on takeoff, detonating their bombs and wiping out the entire 509th and leaving no trained personnel or equipment to deliver additional bombs. And on top of all that, there were a host of other dangers staring Groves and Tibbetts in the face. The threat of Japanese bombing attacks on Tinian, mechanical failures during flight, forcing the crew to jettison their bombs in the sea, or being shot down by enemy fighters or anti-aircraft fire during the mission. Only at the last minute did Groves see the dark clouds gathering around the bomb delivery operation. In less than a month's time, Major Dennings and the Demons, along with the crews on Guam and Midway, were given rush training and sent on their way. "Why was all this kept from public knowledge after the war?" asked Pitt. "What harm could the story of Dennings' Demons cause nearly 50 years later?" "What can I say?" Ingram made a baffled gesture. After 30 years passed and it came up under the Freedom of Information Act, a pair of political hack appointees decided on their own that the American public, who paid their salaries, by the way, was too naive to be entrusted with such an earth-shaking revelation. They reclassified the event as top secret and filed it away in the CIA vault at Langley. "Tibbetts got the glory, and Dennings got deep six," Weatherhill said, waxing philosophical. "So what does Dennings' Demons have to do with us?" Pitt put to Ingram. "Better you should ask Curtis." Ingram nodded to Meeker and sat down. Meeker stepped up to a blackboard on a side wall and took a piece of chalk in one hand. He drew a rough sketch of the B-29 and a long, uneven contour line representing the seafloor that stretched across the board's surface and ended with a sudden rise that was Soseki Island. Thankfully to all in the room, he didn't squeak the chalk. Finally, after adding in a few geological details on the sea bottom, he turned and flashed a warm smile. "Clyde has only given you a brief peek at our satellite surveillance and detection systems," he began. "There are others that have the capability of penetrating through an impressive distance of solid material and measuring a vast array of different energy sources. I won't bother to get into them. Clyde and I aren't here to teach a class, but we'll simply reveal that the explosive device you placed inside the electrical network of the Dragon Center did not do the job." "I've never laid an explosive that failed to detonate," Weatherhill growled on the defensive. "Your charge went off all right," said Meeker, "but not where you said it. If Dr. Nogami was still in deep cover inside the command complex, he could tell you the explosion occurred a good 50 meters from the electrical junction center." "No way," Stacy protested. "I watched Timothy set the charge behind a bundle of optical fibers in an access passage." "It was moved," Dr. Nogami said thoughtfully. "How?" "The inspector robot probably observed a slight drop in the power pulse, searched and found the charge. He would have removed it and notified his robotic control. The timer must have set off the charge while it was being carried through the corridors to robotic control for investigation. Then the Dragon Center is fully operational, Mancuso said with grave foreboding. And the Kaiten project can be primed and detonated, added Stacy, her face displaying lines of disappointment. Meeker nodded. We're afraid that's the case. Then our operation to knock out the center was a bust, Weatherhill said disgustedly. Not really, Meeker explained patiently. You captured Suma, and without him, the cars can't be detonated. Stacy looked confused. What's to stop his fellow conspirators from setting off the bombs? Pitt threw Nogami a bemused look. I suspect the good doctor has the answer. A small bit of information I picked up after becoming chummy with the computer technicians, Nogami said with a wide smile. They allowed me to wander freely in their data center. On one occasion, I stood behind a programmer and looked over his shoulder when he punched in data concerning the Kaiten project. I memorized the entry code, and at my first opportunity, I entered the system. It gave the bomb car locations, which you had already obtained. But I became stymied when I attempted to insert a virus in the detonation system. I discovered only Suma had access to the detonation codes. So no one but Hideki Suma can launch the Kaiten project, Stacy said in relieved surprise. A situation his henchmen are working like hell to correct, answered Meeker. He glanced around at the mate team. But congratulations are still in order. You pulled off a winner. Your efforts effectively shut down the Dragon Center, causing the Japanese to reprogram their prime and detonate systems and giving us enough time to put together a plan to destroy it once and for all. Which, if I'm not sidetracking your lecture, said Pitt quietly, brings us back to Denning's demons. You're quite right, acknowledged Meeker. He hesitated while he sat on a desk. Then he began cutting toward the heart of the briefing. The president was willing to lay his political life on the line and sanction a nuclear strike against the Dragon Center. But he called it off when word came of your escape. Your operation bought him some time, not much, but enough to accomplish what we've planned in the few hours we've got left. You figure on setting off the bomb inside the B-29, Pitt said, his eyes half closed in weariness. Not exactly, Meeker sighed. It will have to be removed and placed a short distance away. Damned if I can see what damage it will cause to an island almost 40 kilometers away, Giordino muttered. A group of the finest oceanographers and geophysicists in the business think that an underwater atomic blast can take out the Dragon Center. I'd like to know how, Stacy said as she swatted at a mosquito that had found one of her bare knees. Meeker refaced the blackboard. Major Dennings could not have known, of course, that his aircraft crashed into the sea and fell to the seafloor close to a perfect location to remove a serious threat to his country 48 years later. He paused and drew another jagged line that traveled under the sea bottom from the plain to Soseki Island and then curved southward. A section of a major Pacific seismic fault system. It travels almost directly beneath the Dragon Center. Nogami shook his head doubtfully. The center was constructed to withstand a major earthquake and a nuclear strike. Exploding an old atomic bomb, providing it can still detonate after 5 decades under salt water, to cause a shift in the fault would prove a wasted effort. Dr. Nogami has a sound argument, said Pitt. The island is almost solid rock. It won't sway and shift during a heavy shockwave. Meeker said nothing for a moment, only smiled. Then he swung the axe. No, it won't sway and shift, he repeated with a fiendish smile. But it will sink.